Brings us into our fourth and final hour with my guests, Rich Hoffman and Robert Powell from the SCU. Still a lot to cover here and a lot of questions coming in from you. We're going to go to the phones as quick as we can. You know, we mentioned in that last hour something we've kicked around on the program before about ufology being its own worst enemy, how it tends to cannibalize itself, eat its young, chew its own feet off, you know, gristle and bone and muscle. And it always happens. Somebody new comes into the field, they get attacked. Lou Elizondo and Chris Mellon would be examples of that. Some of the assaults on their integrity, the claims that they are secret agents working for the deep dark state, that they've infiltrated the UFO subject matter and are misleading us. The same kind of claims that pop up over and over and over again. I think some of their worst critics have had to eat their own words and backtrack a little bit, reluctantly, I would say. I want to ask our guests a little bit about UFO politics, how you get beyond that, because they seeming to amazingly stay out of those kind of brouhahas, and a lot of other stuff to cover as well. So put your thinking caps on, folks. We'll take some questions for you right after this. Before we go to the phones, I want to pop back to that question I was leading up to at the end of the last segment. It was about sort of Skinwalker as the launching point. You know, the Bass people, OSAP, that program that was the precursor to what we know as ATIP, looked at a wide spectrum of peripheral issues and phenomena around UFOs. You know, Bigelow bought the Skinwalker Ranch because there had been UFO and orb sightings there, but then it opened up a whole different kettle of fish, you know, all kinds of weird creatures and phenomena, poltergeist-type things that were studied under OSAP as well as NIDS. And Lou had told me, Elizondo had said on this program, look, to understand the full picture, you're going to need to investigate that. Rich, first you and then Robert, what do you think about that? I know it's a little bit out of your areas, but what do you think of the general concept?
Yeah, it's one of those things that has haunted me for a long time. I actually got started on this thing when I was in the eighth grade science class at age 13. And once my name got out there, I was suddenly receiving all these, like, you know, reports of everything from Bigfoot to strange creatures and everything else. And it started to eat me alive in terms of trying to tackle all the phenomena that's out there. And I just more or less focused on the UFO because I thought, well, I should try to become an expert in this one field and not try to straddle everything that's out there that's weird. And so typically what I've done in UFO cases and stuff like that, I typically like point people to other people and say, hey, look, if you want to look into, you know, this or that, you need to check that out. Now, I have not played a part in the investigation of this ranch and the effects. I've certainly watched it on TV, and I've got two neighbors here that have a direct relationship. Right here in Huntsville, we have Dr. Eric Davis,
yeah,
who was part of that. And then we've also got Dr. Travis Palin from here in Huntsville. And if you've seen the show that was on History Channel where they were covering the Skinwalker Ranch, you could see that even he was impacted by that whole thing because and he became, I guess he had radiation or something of that he was affected by. And I talked with Travis when he before he even went out and did this, and he was going out to basically just prove that there was anything to this whole thing. And he came back from it saying, that, my God, there is something going on here. In fact, he's telling me the fact that he's getting into his car and trying to drive it down the road, and he had problems with the car. Apparently blinkers or something wasn't working. I can't remember the exact story of it now, but he got out and switched seats with his daughter. His daughter came over and had no problems, and they switched again, and then the problems reemerged again. So he was definitely impacted by that whole encounter out there. And I know that a lot of other people, you know, like John Alexander and a whole bunch of others were impacted by going out there. And whether it's radiation or what it is, it needs some attention focused on it. I know that Robert and I attempted to, we actually did get a hold of Brandon Kugel from the standpoint of saying that we'd like to be able to look at the UFO case that they had, that they had filmed, and we never got it. And so we were looking at it at SU to be able to see if we can help help them out. But I think that until we get really involved or brought in or whatever like that, we've just been innocent bystanders like you and scratching our heads.
Robert, you strike me as a nuts and bolts UFO investigator, UAP. You're interested in radar data, things like that. Are you comfortable in pursuing a broader range of related phenomena?
Well, I definitely think, like, the Skinwalker Ranch, that should be investigated. I try to stick with UFOs that are, you know, an actual physical object, but kind of like Rich, that's the area that I like to study, but I definitely believe that the Skinwalker Ranch should be investigated. I don't think that they should just drop it.
Well, it's kind of a tricky political territory. You know, the program was canceled, OSAP, the money was pulled, at least in part, because the people at the Pentagon who had approved it, you know, some of them moved on, but others who were involved at DIA oversight were worried, number one, that the story of this would get on the New York Times and all these weird phenomena that was being investigated would be a big embarrassment for them. And of course, it did get on the New York Times, although it wasn't quite an expose of the ranch. And then secondly, they were worried that it might be satanic or demonic, and that by studying it, you open up the doorway to evil forces, which is, you know, I don't think that studying it makes it worse.
Yeah, very much what Elizondo said that he encountered when he was working in the Pentagon, you know, all of it was considered woo-woo, and basically, just, you know, you had the religious groups that were out there that were doing all the pushback on him, and I think that that's very much present. And I think that you also have historical examples. If you take a look at remote viewing and how that was considered and treated, so I mean, I think a lot of these studies that are out there have been—they're either kept quiet, or they're classified, or they do something with it, and then, you know, it gets pretty weird, and they don't know what to do with it because they don't buy into that kind of crazy stuff, if you would. And so they let it go, and they drop it. And no, you don't do that. You actually apply more science to it because there might be something of major concern there. It could, you know, could be fallout from nuclear kinds of testing that we were doing out there, as many have pointed out, that was also right in direct path to it. And you ought to check it out. But we don't do that. And we look at it as a mystery. And if we can struggle to get some funding to do some limited work, and Brandon's done an excellent job of being able to get a lot of support, get support to doing this. But it needs a lot more, and it shouldn't be dismissed. And it could have direct, you know, connections to the UFO phenomena, but we just don't have enough to go on. And if they're not going to share with their UFO stuff with us, then we're not going to help them out. I mean, it's just, that's the way it is.
Well, somebody comes forward who's willing to check into this stuff, like the Bigelow people and Lou Elizondo and Mellon. They get attacked. They're wacky claims that, you know, they're all DIA agents and, or, you know, deep state agents who are there to spread disinformation. I think a lot of the critics who've done that, the hardest shots at those guys, have had to walk it back a little bit and eat some crow. But it's so common in the field, it's no wonder that a lot of people don't want anything to do with it.
Precisely. And I do think that some of that's changing with, you know the work that you've been doing for decades in terms of getting the word out. And some of the TV shows are helping to educate people. And the news media has been covering it. And so I think it's just and I think younger people will probably work their way into it being more accepting of it than I think the older population would. But I'm hopeful that we can do something with it. And I'm encouraged by the fact that SDU is growing with more and more scientific-minded people that want to get into it. And we do have people that are in social sciences and various other things as well. And so it's not just nuts and bolts. We're looking at some other aspects of it as well. And we need to do that. You need to be open. You need to be, that's what science is about. It starts with observation, and then you take it from there, right?
I want to mention, too, just give you a plug, the SCU links that we have on the Coast to Coast site. You can go there, read the papers. All the material is free. if you want to link up with SCU and be part of the team, it's a 501c3. They need, I think it's probably a pretty lean organization, but you do have expenses. You want to be able to continue investigation so people can contribute to it, and it's tax deductible. And I hope people will check out the link. Let's take some calls here. First time caller, Colleen in Houston, Texas. Hi, Colleen. Welcome to Coast.
Hey, thank you for taking my call, George. How you doing, Richard and Robert? I have two questions I wanted to ask. One, I wanted to ask, since their technology is such advanced, is it possible that they're amongst our civilization, our community, living amongst us, and we don't know because they have ability to change their appearance?
Do either of you guys have a thought on that, or that do they live among us? I mean, maybe they look like us to begin with. They don't need to change their appearance, but any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I guess I'll comment on that. I mean, anything's possible, but my view is if you put yourself in their shoes, I can't imagine us wanting to try to live among a real low-level civilization. So I just would be very doubtful that would ever happen.
You know, I think we don't know how they view us, whether we're the drive-in movie for the galaxy, that they come here to see the crazy humans like watching a zoo, or whether they've always been here and they have some kind of inherent interest in the survival of our planet. We just don't really know. It's fun to speculate. Wildcard line, Dave in Colorado. Hi, Dave.
How are you doing? I have several sightings, but I'm just going to focus on one because it was absolutely during the day. Two summers ago, I was out there watering my trees, and I looked up, and there's this silver cylindrical object that was just sitting there. And I'm going to estimate that it was about 10 miles up in the sky between the Sangre de Cristo Range and Mount Blanca. It was right above there to the northeast. And it just sat there. I mean, it was just still. And if it was going to move, it would have, gone left or right, north or south. And I got my binoculars, my truckers right there. I grabbed my binoculars, but I couldn't focus on it. Then I had enough time. I kept looking up. I had enough time to go grab my 8-inch Meade telescope. And I actually got a bead on it. But what was really trippy, man, the thing started phasing. I couldn't get a focus on it. I had a 25-millimeter eyepiece on it, and I couldn't focus on it. It would not focus. It kept phasing. And then I looked down again, and I looked up, make sure it was still there, moving the telescope a little bit, and I looked up again, and it was gone, completely gone.
Did you report it to anyone?
No, I'm just reporting it now. This is two summers ago.
Well, okay. So for you guys, Rich and Robert, that's a frustrating part of this, is that people see amazing things. Maybe they even get video or photos, and they don't report it to anybody.
Exactly. And I know that that's been a very big frustration for me personally. I give a lot of, lectures to groups, and I know Polly Roberts done the same thing. And the typical question is, how many people here have ever seen something? And then you get, hands that'll go up. And then if you ask them, well, how many reported it? None of them, And so they're not reported. And consequently, there could have been some rational explanation for something. I mean, and believe me, we don't really fully understand everything that's up in the sky. And as humans, and we don't spend a lot of time looking up. And but, then again, there are tools to be able to help us to look and identify, if it might have been an aircraft or whatever like that. But, ultimately, it's one of those things where, you typically go the route of trying to explain it logically. And then when you can't explain it logically, you're left with this unknown, And so I can't account for a silver cylinder that might stay in one place for a very, very long time. But I know that that's not uncommon, and a lot of people have seen that kind of phenomena And some have reported it. I mean, because we've got cases like that that are out there. But ultimately, we need to be able to identify, help us to eliminate that. And plus, we do need additional data that, you know, like, you know, you were speculating the fact that it might have been 10 miles off. And if we had another person that might have been another distance away that saw it, because you didn't report it, we might be able to match it up with a case that was reported. We could actually triangulate it, maybe, and start to get a better understanding of the altitude that the object was at. But we don't get that. And so we need to better equip people like yourself with tools or apps that, you know, that are out there, for example, that can help us to get that data and do better work. Things like Theodolite. Is a better camera to use, and I encourage people to use that versus their cell phone camera, if you would. And Theodolite is a tool that would help us to be able to get better data. It's like the metadata that's around the UFO videos we see, if you would, in the FLIR and some of the Aguadilla cases, because it gives that metadata. But anyway, that's just a real quick comment on my part.
Dave, thanks for the call. I guess the lesson is, folks, anybody listening, is report your UFO sightings. Robert, I want to ask you something based on what David said. It's about his inability to focus on this thing. How often do you hear that in these big cases? I know it pops up. I know that, for example, Hal Puthoff has done some analysis privately about the Tic Tac, the physics of the Tic Tac. People like Kevin Knuth, I think, have done the same thing. Jack Sarfati is online analyzing how these craft work, what the physics are. So I think we understand a lot about how they might work, even though we can't do it. Is there a physics explanation for why it's hard to get a focused video of something like Tic Tac?
Well, so like in David's case, two thoughts come to my mind. The first, of course, is in the excitement of seeing the object, you just don't focus properly, right? So that's one possibility. The other possibility is we often get reports that an object has a appearance around it similar to a hot summer day where you have a mirage on the surface due to heat. So if due to a heat or a plasma, an object had that type of appearance around it, then you're going to have difficulty focusing on it.
Yeah, I just didn't know if there's a, you know, speculation about these fields being generated by whatever the propulsion system is, that they might interfere with the ability to get a good, clear picture or video.
Yeah, that could be a possibility.
Let me also mention, like, you know, if you look at the Delphos, Kansas case, for example, you know, you have a situation where the object came down and had, like, created a ring around it. And if you remember that it was, like, an extremely bright object to the point where it actually... Ronnie Johnson's vision was impacted, as well as they believe that the Snowball, the dog, was impacted. So there's that, and the fact that there might be some sort of field around the objects that we just don't understand, and right. Then that field alone is,
I got to go to a break. Rich Hoffman, Robert Powell, we have another segment coming up. We'll get to as many of your calls as we can. I am generally a... glass half empty kind of a guy, but I'm feeling kind of optimistic about 2021 with regard to the UAP subject. The UAP task force, as we discussed earlier, has some handcuffs, has some obstacles in its way, but Congress is interested. They want information. Whether or not that task force can produce the comprehensive report about the big picture UFO stuff is a question, but maybe there'll be some progress on other areas, and maybe there's some breakthroughs that'll be coming later this year. I'm hopeful. Anyway, we have one segment remaining with my guests, Rich Hoffman and Robert Powell from the SCU. The phone lines are absolutely full. We'll get to as many of your calls as we can right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Rich Hoffman, Robert Powell, looks like you guys are a hit. Our phones are pretty much full here. We're going to go to the east of the Rockies, Bruce in Western Canada. Hi, Bruce. What's on your mind?
Hi, George. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to say, first off, thank you to Rich and Robert and your other guests for beginning the process to document what's going on out there. We can wait for disclosure. We may get it. We may not. But it has to be science and the public that begin to document what's going on out there. I had a sighting in April 18th during the time, peak time of COVID here in Western Saskatchewan, and I still can't explain it. I'm in the process of documenting it still. It's been months later now. I've even canvassed my neighborhood, and I had another individual verify what I saw. And both of us are just still amazed that we turned around and said, have you ever seen anything move like that? There was two objects. Have you ever seen anything fly away that fast? We can't explain it. What I can't explain even more, and this isn't a documentation of it, within an hour of what we saw, and it was 3:30 in the morning, Saturday, April 18th, 2020, was military aircraft. Were they pursuing these objects? There was two objects.
Yeah.
Were they tracking them? And we're talking KC-10s. We're talking AWACS. I knew I had to phone in for your guests because stuff is going on, and some of us accidentally pay attention. I had my window open. The dog started barking, and then suddenly they stopped barking. And two objects come in from the south over our city and from 25,000, 20,000 feet, drop right into the city, and then suddenly just veer off to the northeast. I still can't explain it. I'm amazed to see what I saw. And for your guests, my question to them is, it's going to be your system with the public that begins to verify that this phenomenon actually exists.
Robert, any thoughts?
I missed his last question. Could you repeat it for me, George?
Well,
go ahead. Go ahead, Bruce.
Both what you're accomplishing and the science behind what's going on. Like the very fact that you said some of these objects are going 1,900 miles an hour, I can verify what I saw. I've never seen anything travel like that. Stop and then change direction.
Bruce, go ahead.
This is Rich. I've had many cases like what you're describing. In fact, I had one in Mississippi that would involve everything from a sphere to a triangle and a helicopter all at the same time. And it was just a fascinating case. But anyway, let me just say that our hope is that by treating this very scientifically methodologically, that if we're doing our job, then we're going to help vindicate that there's a lot of witnesses that are seeing these things, even though they don't maybe have the opportunity to take, you know, video or photos or data or whatever like that. Our belief is very strongly that we're going to help vindicate the fact that there's something up there that we are all seeing. And that's my hope. I mean, I'm hoping that we're going to be doing what should have been done a long, long time ago to help support all the witnesses that have always come forward with this subject. Now, granted, there's a lot of times we're able to find out we can explain it naturally, but there's a lot of other times we just can't. And so I applaud you, and I hope that you'll document like you say you did.
Bruce, thanks for the call. Let me ask you quickly, if you're still there, how soon after your sighting did the military aircraft show up? And could you tell, are they Canadian military or are they American, U.S.?
This is what's very interesting, is we don't live near military bases. The closest bases will be Cold Lake, Alberta, or Minot, North Dakota. The aircraft that came in our area, and remember, this is during COVID, so you have no aircraft flying at all at night. Anywhere, you might have some east to west for Trans-Canada, for high aircraft up at 30,000 or more feet. But what happens is, within an hour, you had military aircraft in the area. I'm going to say that they may have came from Minot, perhaps Omaha, who knows. They were U.S. military aircraft. And the other thing is that continued the next day. To 3:30 the next day in the morning as well. They weren't on exercise. They were doing a grid, and it was amazing to see that this stuff, whatever came here first, an hour later, somebody else is checking out, you know, the area as what's going on.
Bruce, thank you for the call. Appreciate it. Maybe these guys can find out if there are any other reports of the same kind of activity. Appreciate the information. West of the Rockies, Terry in Modesto, California. Hi, Terry.
Hi. I was stationed at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, back in September of 1958, and I was doing teletype and Morse code and all that. That's when I first got sick. Then the last was on June 9th of 2015. I was wondering, do they have anything on that timing? Because I was out from the 9th of June to the 15th of June. Totally out, saw a doctor. He did not know anything was wrong. I can find no one who's heard of this. These guys are only checking parts of it, but there's some of us who get ill from it in some manner.
Wait, you're saying that you got ill because of something you saw in the sky, a sighting?
I have no idea what causes it. All I know is I was here in my house. All of a sudden, I started getting sick and started getting real sick. I took off walking, stopped a lady, asked her to call an ambulance, and I blacked out mentally, but not physically. I did not come to from the 9th of June to the 15th of June. And I'd seen a doctor, been back to my home and all. I can find no one who even believe it. Not even my children, doctors, lawyers, nobody.
Terry, let me ask these guys. Have either of you ever heard of well-documented cases where there's some health effects of people having UFO sightings? I guess close encounters, maybe.
Robert, did you want to say something?
I'll let you go, Rich.
No, I've had cases that I've experienced where people had, you know, like felt like either lightheaded or they felt a little bit ill. And of course, then you've got the cases like, the radiation burns and various other things. You got the ones up in Canada with the
Steve Michalak.
Yeah, I mean, so you have all these different kinds of cases that are out there where people do have effects from them. But I'm not hearing her describe something that she saw an object, so we don't have a connection to an actual object itself. But anyway, so I'm just pointing out the fact that there are cases where people do get negative effects from it.
Okay. Terry, thanks for the call. First-time caller aligned, Steve in Anchorage. Hi, Steve. Welcome to Coast to Coast.
Yeah, hi, George. I just wanted to tell you that you're a first-class act up here in Alaska to all the miners and trappers in their cabin. Anyways, I have a comment regarding magnesium. When I was a kid, I used to dig in the dumpsters at TRW when I lived in Redondo Beach, and I used to take it home and I would light it on fire, and I did a little research. Magnesium is usually cast with another metal like aluminum, and it's usually a lesser metal, but when it's in pure form and it catches on fire, you can't put it out. You need a special compound called Purple K. When they had fires on ships, it would burn all the way down to the water line. So he mentioned that was 99% magnesium. So anyway, that's my comment. And thanks again, you guys. Good night.
Thanks, Steve. You know, I had a friend of mine, you can guess the name, who used to make homemade firework shows, and he would shred magnesium and put it atop gasoline and explosives, and wow, it's a heck of a firework. Any thoughts, Robert, on the properties of magnesium?
Your guest made a very good point. It is very difficult to put magnesium out once you ignite it. And so, like in the case of the Brazil incident, these pieces of magnesium hit the water and all along the shoreline, and that's how this guy got the pieces of them. So I think it was the water that extinguished the magnesium.
We're jumping to wildcard line Shane in Sacramento. Hi, Shane. Welcome to Coast to Coast.
I want to say, George, I'm a really big fan of your work. My wife and I always enjoy when you're on. We never miss it.
Thank you, sir.
I want to say thank you. Appreciate it. And both the gentlemen here, When you guys were talking about the Texas case and how it was, when it took off, it rotated a 90 degree. Didn't Bob Lazar say something similar of how it rotated 90 degree and then took off?
That's true. Yeah.
Okay. And, wanted to say also, thank you guys for your work. Appreciate it. It must be hard being taken seriously in this field. So I really appreciate your guys' work. Thank you.
Thanks, Shane. So, Robert, do you have any idea on how far away we are from developing anti-gravity technology? That's the holy grail, right?
Yeah, I don't think we're anywhere near that.
So the kinds of abilities that were displayed by gimbal, tic-tac, we don't have that yet, do we?
No, and it would take more than just anti-gravity per se, right? Because you can be out in space where there's no gravity, and you could not achieve high acceleration. So it takes more than just anti-gravity. It would take something else, such as it's all speculative, so I don't even want to go there. But anti-gravity itself is not sufficient.
All right. Wayne in Tacoma on the wild card line. Hi, Wayne. Wayne, are you there? All right, we're going to move on. Ted in Bozeman, Montana. You're on Coast to Coast with Rich Hoffman and Robert Powell.
Good evening, George and guys. Really interesting show. A number of years ago, like about 20 years ago, I received an invitation to come out to Los Alamos and interview for a UFO job because my secrecy agreement that I had signed when I worked in another magic program, which lasts 20 years for the above top secret code word stuff, had expired, and they wanted to put me back underneath the more stringent security thing. And I was talking to the interviewer who was the assistant director of the CIA in the Foreign Intelligence Division. And he said, we'd love to have you come to work for us in the UFO program, and we want you to go get a degree in physics and then come back. And I said, well, why would I want to do that? Because 75% of what I'd learned at college would be wrong. And he looked at me like I had raw grass coming out of my mouth, and he kind of rubbed his chin a little bit, and he said, you know, you're right. 75% of what they learn in the universities is not the way things work. But we will teach you the 75% that is right so that you can work effectively in the UFO program.
So, Ted, they told you it's a UFO program.
What?
They told you it's a UFO program? I mean, what did they mean? That we have UFOs, that we're operating
Absolutely.
Them? Or, yeah.
Absolutely, we have them. I've met Bob Lazar a couple times, and John has taken me out to Mailbox Road to watch him. And I told my wife about it after I got back. I was flying 727s at the time. And, you know, you see a lot of UFOs when you're flying. I'd see sometimes five or six a day. And I told my wife about it, that John had taken me up to the Mailbox Road. And she wanted to go out and watch UFOs fly. So we arranged to do it. And I had just gotten off a four-day trip. And so I was laying down in the back of the airplane where there were no people. And she was sitting up front looking out the window. And all of a sudden, a UFO comes up and joins up on the right wing of the airplane. And she's trying to wake me up and look at this UFO. And needless to say, I didn't wake up in time to see it. But after that, she said, well, there's no need to go on out to Las Vegas, because we had one go right on off the end of the wingtip. And I've seen them up, you know, within 30 or 40 feet. It's just unbelievable.
Ted, thank you for sharing that. Robert, let me ask you, do you know of, you know, we've seen historical records of anti-gravity research programs. I think John Lear's father was involved in it, Bill Lear, back in the 50s. But Is there any research going on into that now that you know of?
I don't know specific research, but I know just in general that I'm sure there are people who are looking at that. But I'm not aware of anyone who's had any success.
We got like a minute left. Rich, is this a solvable mystery? Can we get our heads around whatever the answer to it is? Can we discover it on our own, or did these visitors, assuming they're visitors, have to share it and open up the books or whatever to explain it to us?
Well, that's an excellent question. I mean, I've been spending most of my life, and I know others have been doing the same thing, waiting for the answers to come. We're getting, I think we're getting smarter. I mean, I think that you're starting to see a lot of that space-time metric engineering that being, theorized, if you would. I think that we're looking at, now having more intellect being applied and some openness that's going on, that I'm encouraged like you. I think that there might be something that we'll learn, and I think that our technology is improving to the point where we can actually get better data and information, and so I'm hopeful that at some point we'll be able to really get some very good answers to this whole phenomena, and I would just be thrilled to death.
Yeah, me too. Richard Hoffman, Robert Powell, you guys are doing great work for SCU. I encourage people to check out your website. And Robert, I'm sure you got something really cool cooking, and whenever you uncork it, I hope you'll come back. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Dr. Kevin Knuth, who was on too briefly. We hope he'll return as well. And thanks to my colleagues there at Coast to Coast, Melissa Rodriguez and Michael Cosio, Donna Walker, webmaster Lex Lonehood, Dan Galante, and Chris Boros. I'm George Knapp. I'll be back next Saturday night. George Norrie is back here tomorrow night, actually tonight. Good night, everyone.